Jersey was just a short distance from New York City, where some of the best doctors and dentists in the world had their practices. On January 25th, Hazel, bravely swallowing down her pain, made the journey into the Big Apple for treatment at the office of Dr. Theodore Bloom. Bloom was one of America's first oral surgeons, a prestigious specialist who had pioneered the use of X-rays for dental diagnosis. His fees were extortionate, but Theo insisted that they visit him anyway. He could borrow money on their furniture to pay the bills, he reasoned. If it eased Hazel's pain, if Dr. Bloom could stop this endless decay in her mouth, then it would all be worth it. As a mechanic, Theo Kooser was not wealthy, and nor was his family. His father, also called Theo, was a postman. Theo Sr. had saved up money to buy a house for his old age, but he now offered some of his savings to his son for Hazel's treatment. He took it gratefully, and the appointment was duly attended. Bloom was a balding man with a neatly trimmed mustache, spectacles, and a high forehead. As he introduced himself to Hazel and began his examination, he quickly realized that he had never seen a condition like hers before. Her face was swollen with pus bags, but it was the condition of her jawbone that was most perplexing. It seemed almost moth-eaten. It literally had holes in it. But what, Dr. Bloom now pondered, could have caused it? Bloom was worth his money. Later, he would try to find out the exact chemicals in the luminous paint, although to no avail. For now, he took a medical and employment history from Hazel and made a provisional diagnosis. She was suffering from poisoning by a radioactive substance. He admitted her to the Flower Hospital in New York to operate on her jaw. It would be the first, but not the last, of such procedures Hazel had to endure. Yet, although Bloom had offered a diagnosis and swift and specialist treatment, he didn't offer the one thing that Theo had been yearning for, hope. That was all he really wanted, to know that there was light at the end of the tunnel, that they could get through this and come out on the other side into a shining day, and another one, and another day after that. Instead, Bloom told him, there is little chance of recovery. All the money in the world couldn't save his wife now. The radium girl's agony hadn't gone unnoticed in the community. That same month, a civic-minded resident wrote to the Department of Labor to raise concerns about the orange plant. This time, it was John Roach's boss, Commissioner Andrew McBride, who stepped in, grilling Health Officer Lenore Young on what she'd found out the previous summer. She apologized for seeming negligent, interviewed the affected girls, and then recommended that the Public Health Service be called in. Yet McBride felt there was not sufficient evidence to warrant doing so. His reasoning may have been political, for the Department of Labor was pro-business. Under state law, it had no authority to stop an industrial process, even if it was harmful. As a result of these factors, the department now gave the plant a clean bill of health and completely stopped looking into the dial painter's illnesses. They made this decision even though more and more women were suffering the same symptoms. It was a stalemate. No diagnosis, no clue as to the cause. No one lifting a finger to find out what was really going on in that radium studio in Orange. But then the stalemate was ended by an unexpected source, the United States Radium Corporation itself. As more and more girls fell ill, the company found that, in a stark contrast to the glory days in the war, it was encountering considerable difficulty recruiting staff. A number of the girls had quit, and no one wanted to replace them. Production was now being held up. When Genevieve Smith, shocked into action by her best friend Marguerite's decline, also handed in her resignation on February 20th, 1924, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. Veit, the vice president, was ordered to find out why Genevieve was leaving, and she cited Dr. Barry's ultimatum. The dentist was persisting with his outlandish claims. The lack of operators was a big concern to the company, but there was another worrying development about the same time that really made them sit up and take note of what was happening to their former employees. For more than 3 years, Grace Vincent, Hazel's mother, had been watching her daughter suffer. Hazel was in constant agony. No mother could bear it. Dr. Bloom had said there was no hope now, and Mrs. Vincent had nothing to lose. She went down to the studio in Orange and left a letter there. In it, she told the firm she was about to make a claim for compensation on account of her daughter's illness. That got their attention. At once, Veit reported these developments to the New York headquarters. Not long after, USRC executives decided to launch an investigation to determine if there was anything dangerous in the work. For too long there had been rumor and suspicion. It couldn't continue. After all, now it was bad for business. 12. In a sign of how seriously the company was taking the downturn in its operations, President Arthur Roeder himself took charge of the investigation. In March 1924, he approached Dr. Cecil K. Drinker, professor of physiology at the Harvard School of Public Health, and asked him if he would conduct a study at the Orange plant. Drinker was a qualified MD, as well as a recognized authority in occupational disease. Roeder was taking no chances, but bringing in the very best. To Drinker, Roeder wrote, "We must determine definitely and finally if the material is in any way harmful." To Roeder's delight, Drinker found his letter very interesting and offered to meet him in April for further discussion. Roeder told him of two cases, one fatal, probably Irene Rudolph, and one very much improved. Roeder emphasized knowingly of the latter, "I have been informed that her family have had considerable tubercular trouble." In response, Drinker advised that, "We are inclined to feel..." Drinker worked with his equally brilliant wife, Dr. Catherine Drinker, and another doctor called Dr. Castle, "that the two occurrences which you mention have been coincidences." However, he added, "At the same time, we are agreed that it is not at all safe to permit any conviction upon that point without a rather complete examination." In April 1924, the study would begin. It is not wholly clear who Roeder meant by his very much improved case. It was probably Marguerite Carlo, since she was the woman who had left his employ most recently, although, in fact, she was still greatly suffering. But it could also have been Grace Fryer, who was finally reaping the benefits of the expensive medical care she was paying for. Dr. Humphreys was still examining her once a week to see how her strapped back and feet were doing. Now, at last, he was happy to note she was improving. Humphreys, however, had care only of Grace's body, and it was her jaw that was now becoming her major source of pain. The same month Roeder wrote to Drinker, Grace was admitted to hospital in New York for a week-long stay. Her latest round of X-rays showed a chronic infectious process in the jaw, and she sought treatment from Dr. Francis McCaffrey, a specialist who operated on her, excising some of her jawbone. As Kniff and Barry had found, however, Once an operation had been carried out, another was needed, and then another after that. I have been compelled to go to the hospital so often, Grace later said, that it seems like a second home. Grace, as had so many of her former colleagues, now became trapped in a vicious circle, with each operation incurring yet another bill. Before too long, she had to swallow her pride and ask her parents for money, but the rising medical costs desecrated both her savings and the family's bank account. That spring, USRC, too, was concerned about money. April seemed rather distant for a drinker's investigation to begin, given the pressing delay in production at the plant. Though Veit had managed to hire an extra 6 girls, it wasn't enough. The executives still had to address the psychological and hysterical situation that was now unfolding in the studio. So, while it waited for Drinker to begin his study, the firm organized its own examinations of the current team of dial painters, conducted by the Life Extension Institute. The girls were tested confidentially, but the reports were shared with the firm. The individuals concerned, Veit wrote Roeder, do not know that we have these copies. Information given in them is very confidential, and they might object to our having them. Though the Institute found some girls had infected teeth, it concluded that their ailments did not reflect any specific occupational influence. Roeder wrote contentedly to Veit that the results were just as I anticipated. Veit, however, who was more involved in operations at the studio, was not so reassured. I do not feel quite as optimistic about this matter as you do, he wrote to his boss. While the Life Extension Institute have made a report, I do not believe that this will satisfy our various operators, and that we must wait for Dr. Drinker's final report in order to really convince them that there is no injurious element. Roeder then added his own 2 cents. We should create an atmosphere in the plant of competence, he wrote decidedly to Veit. An atmosphere of confidence is just as contagious as one of alarm and doubt. And he advised that, in his view, the most important action is to see Barry and perhaps others who have been making statements, having jumped at conclusions apparently without thought or knowledge. Veit knew an instruction when he heard one. In late March 1924, he duly paid a visit to Barry and Davidson. The dentists received him coolly. They had no doubt that the agonizing condition they were seeing in their patients was due to the girls' former employment at USRC. During Veit's visit, they became outraged by what they considered a cold-blooded attitude. You ought to close down the plant, Davidson told Veit angrily. You've made $5 million. Why go on killing people for more money? Veit had no answer. If I could have my way, Davidson told him bitterly, I would close your plant. The dentists weren't the only ones whose interaction with the girls had brought them to the point of frustration. Lenore Young, the Orange health officer, having seen the Department of Labor do nothing with her recommendation that the Public Health Service be called in, now, discreetly, took matters into her own hands. On April 4th, 1924, she wrote confidentially to Catherine Wiley, the executive secretary of the Consumers League, a national organization that fought for better working conditions for women. The authorities are hesitating, Young confided in Wiley. The Consumers League must keep after them to see that something happens. Wiley was a smart and enterprising woman in charge of the New Jersey branch of the league. a somewhat plain, dark-haired lady in her early 30s, with features too small for her face. She was a tenacious and driven person. When Young asked for her help, Wiley responded immediately. She was assisted by John Roach from the Department of Labor, who, unknown to his boss, McBride, gave Wiley a list of the women affected so she could conduct her own investigation. It came not a moment too soon, for on April 15, 1924, another young woman lost her life. Jenny Stalker, who Dr. Humphreys had been trying to treat for her peculiar knee condition without avail, died suddenly after a short illness at the age of 20. The day after she died, Roeder kept his appointment with the drinkers. He showed them around the plant, and then they went up to the studio and spoke to several of the women, including Marguerite Carlo. It is surprising that she was in the studio, and not simply because she no longer worked there. Since Christmas Eve 1923, she had been confined to her home, except for her visits to Dr. Barry. It is possible that the company had asked her to come in specially to meet the drinkers, being determined to lay to rest the rumors that Marguerite's work had made her sick. She was accompanied by her sister, Sarah Mileffer, who now walked with a cane. Sarah was still working at the plant as a dial painter. The Carlo family was poor, and with Marguerite no longer able to work and the medical bills mounting, they needed every penny they could get. Sarah's trouble, of course, was very different from that of Marguerite. Evidently, her lame leg was not connected to the awful disease that was plaguing Marguerite's mouth. Dr. Cecil Drinker was a handsome man with abundant fair hair. He introduced himself to Marguerite with immediate concern for her well-being. Her thin face was very pale, and she clutched a bandage to her seeping cheek. She complained of pains in the bones of her face. It was obvious that she was seriously ill. Catherine Drinker turned to Roeder and told him that the day's tour could not be considered an adequate survey. It was imperative, she said, that the drinkers return to Orange to make a comprehensive study of the plant and its employees. And so, over 2 days, from May 7th to 8th, 1924, the full drinker study took place. The scientists, now fully read up on all the radium literature, returned to the plant with their colleague Dr. Castle and conducted a detailed investigation. Together, the three doctors inspected all the different facets of the operation, accompanied on their tour by Vice President Veit. They met the chief chemist, Dr. Edwin Lehman, and noted that he had serious lesions on his hands. Yet when they mentioned them, he scoffed at the possibility of future damage. Perhaps he was mindful of his president's suggestion that an atmosphere of confidence should be promulgated by the plant's top men. Such an unconcerned attitude, the drinkers soon realized, was characteristic of those in authority throughout the plant. There seemed to be, Cecil Drinker later wrote, an utter lack of realization of the dangers inherent in the material which was being manufactured. Roeder even told him that no malignant growths ever developed on the basis of radium lesions, a statement so easy to disprove as to be ridiculous. Up in the studio, the doctors carried out thorough medical examinations of the workers. 25 employees were selected as a representative number. One by one, the nominated dial painters knocked nervously on the door of the restroom, where the women's tests were held, before being summoned in. Sarah Mileffer was one of those chosen. As the doctors requested, she opened her mouth wide so they could prod at her teeth. kept still as they probed firmly around her nose and throat, offered the vulnerable inside of her arm so they could take a vial of blood. The exam then transferred to the dark room. Here, Catherine Drinker examined a number of these women, some quite intimately, to determine to what degree they were luminous when sufficiently in the dark. Oh, that luminosity! That glow! Catherine Drinker was stunned by it. As the women undressed in the dark room, she witnessed the dust lingering on their breasts, their undergarments, the inside of their thighs. It scattered everywhere, as intimate as a lover's kiss, leaving its trace as it wound around the women's limbs, across their cheeks, down the backs of their necks, and around their waists. Every inch of them was marked by it, by its feather-like dance that touched their soft and unseen skin. It was spectacular and tenacious once it had infiltrated the women's clothing. The drinkers noted that it persisted in the skin even after vigorous washing. The drinkers didn't limit their study to the plant. They visited Dr. Barry and also met some of the dial painters who were now exhibiting such similar symptoms, including Grace Fryer. Thanks to the attentions of the expert Dr. McCaffrey in New York, however, Grace was the exception to the rule. The drinkers were pleased to note she had recovered satisfactorily from her illness. The same could not be said for Marguerite Carlo. Finding no relief with Barry, she had started consulting Dr. Kniff, who'd treated Molly Maggia. Marguerite's appearance, she who had once favored dramatic feathered hats and glossy fashion, was by now very bad. Yet the worst was not on the outside, despite her deathly pale skin and emaciated body, but on the inside, from the constant discharge of foul pus in her mouth. She was suffering excruciatingly. Kniff attended her as best he could. "At least once a day I'd go up there," he remembered. It was a 15 to 20 mile drive from his office to the Carlo home on Main Street, Orange, but on occasion he would attend her from 2 to 6 times a day. Sometimes, he recalled, "I have been with her as high as 3 days and 3 nights on a stretch." Such close attention was well beyond the budget of the Carlos, so Kniff was essentially working for free. It was good of him, but it didn't necessarily mean that Marguerite was receiving the best qualified attention. Yet Kniff knew more than most about the disease, even if he didn't, at that time, understand the full implications of his growing knowledge. Dr. Kniff was a medical man through and through. When Molly Maggia's jawbone had so shockingly broken against his fingers, he had been fascinated by it, so he had kept it, this oddly moth-eaten, misshapen piece of bone. Every now and again, after her death, he had examined it, turning it over in his hands, but he was none the wiser. Anyway, she had died of syphilis, whatever the strangeness of her bones. He'd, therefore, popped the fragment into his desk drawer, where he kept his X-ray negatives, and eventually it slipped his mind. And then, one day, his duties had required him to dig through that crowded desk drawer for the X-ray films. He had scrambled through the bits and pieces he kept in there, searching for them. To his astonishment, when he finally pulled them out, the films were no longer ebony black. Instead, they were fogged, as though something had been emanating onto them. But there was nothing in that drawer but old files and forgotten scraps of bone. He turned the X-ray film this way and that. The spoiling of the film was undeniable. It was a message, though little did Kniff know it, but its meaning was unclear. Molly Maggio was still voiceless, even after all this time. 13. Though Kniff did not know why the films were fogged, Marguerite Carlo appreciated his considerable attentions nonetheless. With a spark of hope, she said that, of late, she had felt a little better. But visiting doctors noted that was a statement not in accord with her appearance. When Catherine Wiley from the Consumers League met her in May 1924 as part of her independent investigation, she was shocked, calling her this poor, sick young thing who looked fairly transparent. The level of sheer suffering was difficult to witness. Wiley later wrote, "After seeing one of the victims, I can never rest until I have seen something done, whereby I am assured it will not happen again." She resolved to stick to this thing until there is some action somewhere. And stick to it she did. She interviewed more of the girls, including Josephine Smith, but found her unwilling to discuss the subject while continuing to be employed by the corporation. Wiley left no stone unturned, also visiting Catherine Sharb and Edith Mead, who had nursed Molly Maggio through her terrible illness. The nurse had not forgotten her former boarder. "Miss Mead wishes," Wiley wrote, "to do anything that she can to prevent such a tragedy happening to anyone else." And Wiley felt exactly the same. Hearing of Hazel's mother's desire to claim compensation, she consulted a local judge to get his advice on how the families could take legal action. But here, she learned that New Jersey law was set against the women. The state, in fact, had somewhat pioneering legislation. A new law had come in only that January that made industrial diseases compensable. But, and it was a big but, only 9 diseases were on the permitted list, and there was a 5-month statute of limitations, meaning any legal claim had to be filed within 5 months of the point of injury. Not only was radium poisoning, if indeed that was what the girls were suffering from, not on the list, but most of the girls had not been employed by USRC for years, let alone 5 months. The judge told Wiley frankly, "When radium poisoning is made a compensable disease, if ever, it would not be retroactive, so that, as far as these girls were concerned, nothing could be done." The families had hit the same brick wall. Stone broke and desperate, Marguerite Carlo was now considering legal action in order to get some money to pay for her treatment, but neither she nor Hazel Kuzer's family had been able to find a lawyer who would take the case without getting cash up front. As Wiley noted grimly, they have none. On May 19, 1924, Wiley returned to the Department of Labor with the results of her investigation. She took them straight to the top, to Commissioner Andrew McBride, but he was furious to find that the Consumers League had stuck its nose into the matter. When he learned that his deputy, Roach, had supplied Wiley with the women's names, he hit the roof. McBride summoned Roach to their meeting and, Wiley said, rebuked him in my presence in a severe calling down. Wiley wasn't daunted one bit by McBride's ferocity, however. She continued to argue with him. McBride, frustrated with this nagging woman, asked her what she wanted to happen. "An investigation by the U.S. Public Health Service," she said, immediately. "Put it in writing," he replied, wearily. She did, at once. Even as Wiley was continuing to champion the women's cause, developments were afoot at the center of all the trouble, the United States Radium Corporation. The drinkers had been busy assessing the results of all their tests, and now, on June 3, 1924, they delivered their full and final report to the firm. 15 days later, on June 18th, Veit wrote to Roach at the Department of Labor to share the doctor's verdict. He didn't send the full report, which was lengthy, simply a table of the medical test results of the workers, which showed the employee's blood to be practically normal. "I do not believe," wrote Veit confidently, "that this table shows a condition any different than a similar examination would show of the average industrial worker." The department agreed. The table showed that every girl is in perfect condition. The company was in the clear. President Roeder wasted no time in spreading the news. "He tells everyone," an observer commented, "he is absolutely safe because he has a report exonerating him from any possible responsibility in the illnesses of the girls." Immediately, just as Roeder had hoped, the situation improved at the plant. "Rumors quieted considerably," noted an internal memo with satisfaction. It was, therefore, unfortunate timing that at this moment Dr. Theodore Bloom begged the company to help his patient, Hazel Kuser. Since she'd first visited Bloom in January, her condition had deteriorated rapidly, despite many operations, 2 blood transfusions, and multiple hospital stays. The bills were coming in faster than Theo Kuser and his father could pay them. Though Hazel's wealthy physicians, intrigued by her strange condition, were providing her with a significant amount of free treatment, the bills ran into the thousands. Theo was mortgaging everything he owned, while his father's life savings hurtled into a financial black hole, swallowed up as soon as father and son withdrew them from the bank. Her father could not afford the care Hazel urgently needed, so Bloom appealed directly to the company. He made sure to say that he wasn't trying to lay the blame at the firm's door, even though by this time Bloom was willing to state that the disease was undoubtedly caused by the material used in dial painting. "It is not a question of whether or not your firm is responsible," he wrote carefully, "but I feel that if you have the money to spare, you should let them have it in some way." He wasn't interested in culpability. This was a matter of life and death. The response from USRC was swift. Full of the confidence given them by the drinker's report, the company refused to help in any way whatsoever. To do so would establish a precedent which we do not consider wise. 5 years before, the firm had been stung when they'd offered $5 compensation for some ruined laundry. They were not going to make the same mistake again. Instead, they gloried in the conclusions of the recent study. "The results of the very thorough investigation which we made upon this condition, which you claimed was caused by her employment in our plant, have shown that there was nothing in our work which might be considered the cause." The letter concluded, somewhat insincerely, "We are sorry that we cannot help you in this way." Bloom was stunned. "I was only appealing to the humane sense of the officers of your corporation to find out what you would do to help this poor creature," he wrote back. "I must admit that I am surprised that you failed to see the humane side of the question." But the corporation cared not a jot for his jibes. They were guiltless, and they had a report that proved it. 14. Catherine Sharb couldn't wait for her summer holiday. It had been a horrible 12 months, her cousin Irene dying last July, almost a year ago now, and then Catherine's own trouble with her teeth, starting in November. She knew she was now called a nervous case by her doctors, but as much as she tried not to think about her situation, it was very hard not to. She had recently taken work in an office with the idea that it would help take her mind off things. As it turned out, Catherine had become a bit of a flibbertigibbet in her career, flipping from one company to the next, leaving due to ill health or her nerves, or because she was looking for the next, much-needed distraction. She would move from the roller-bearing company to an insurance company to a motor car firm and back again, never staying in one place especially long, always having to leave for one reason or another. Anyway, wherever it was she was working, most of her earnings had to go on medical treatment. Her state of mind worried her father, William, she knew. He was so good to her, always trying to lift her spirits or paying one of her doctor's bills from his own wages. He didn't earn much. He was a janitor in a factory, and the family lived in a dingy third-floor flat. But he was happy to give all he could to his daughter if it would make her well. This summer, Catherine planned to take a much-needed rest. She was only 22, an age Irene had never seen, she realized sadly, and she needed to remember what it was to feel young. All this worry was dragging her down. Yet, when July 1924 arrived, Catherine noted, "I could not go away. The condition in my jaw was causing me considerable anxiety, and I decided to consult a skilled dental surgeon in New York City. I had to use my vacation money for a new set of X-rays." By chance, although perhaps not given his standing in his field, she chose to consult Dr. Bloom, who was also treating Hazel Couser. Back in May, Catherine had had another tooth pulled by a different dentist. As was now becoming the distressing norm, the socket had not healed. The infection was agonizing. "The pain I have suffered," she said, "could only be compared with the pain caused by a dentist drilling on a live nerve hour after hour, day after day, month after month." When Bloom examined her in July 1924, he advised work to be done when she is in a physical condition to have it done. Until then, Catherine had to return home unaided. It was the not knowing what was wrong that was the worst thing, she thought. "I had stopped at nothing in an effort to regain my lost health, but so far I had failed," she mused dejectedly. "No one was able to help me." She was at Bloom's office again and again over the summer, not quite the vacation she had planned. Once she was compelled to obtain an emergency appointment after suffering agonies in the entire right side of her head. She pulled her blonde hair back from her thin face in his office, trying to demonstrate to Bloom where the pain was, all down the right side of her skull. Bloom gently probed at her swollen jaw, and, upon pressure, pus discharged from the tooth socket. Catherine felt it burst into her mouth and felt sick. "Why should I be so afflicted?" she would later ask. "I have never harmed a living thing. What have I done to be so punished?" On one of her visits to Bloom, she ran into Hazel, who was there for treatment too. She was unrecognizable. This mysterious new condition in some patients led to grotesque facial swellings, literal footballs of fluid sprouting from their jaws, and it seems Hazel may have been afflicted in this way. Accompanied by her mother, she was in no condition to talk. It was Grace Vincent, having to be her daughter's voice, who told Catherine that Hazel had been seeing Bloom for the past 6 months. It could not have been a good advertisement for the dentist's skills. Before the summer was out, Hazel would be rushed to a hospital in New York, where she would stay for 3 months, far from her family and Theo in Newark. To pay for her hospital treatment, her husband mortgaged their home to the hilt. And Hazel and Catherine weren't the only ones seeing doctors. Back in Orange, Quinta McDonald was finding it harder and harder to look after her little ones. Her daughter, Helen, was now 4 years old. Baby Robert had just turned one. It was the pain in her hip that was the problem, shooting all down her right leg. She was hobbling about now with more than just a noticeable limp. It was more like a lurch as she stumbled from one foot to the next. It was the strangest thing, but, she said, it seemed to me that one leg was shorter than the other. She must be imagining it. All the 24 years of her life her limbs had measured up straight. Why would that suddenly change now? Nevertheless, it was debilitating, especially with Robert crawling about the house at 100 miles per hour and her increasingly unable to keep up with him. She made an appointment with Dr. Humphreys at the Orange Orthopedic Hospital, perhaps recommended to her by Grace Fryer. In August 1924, Humphreys took an X-ray and perused it for analysis. He'd noted in his physical examination of Quinta that she could not move her hip to complete function, so he was looking especially for a problem around her hip joint. Ah, there it was. But what was it? On the X-ray, there was a white shadow, as Humphreys called it. It was peculiar, showing a white modeling throughout the bone. He had never seen anything quite like it. As John Roach later wrote of the bewildering maladies, "The whole situation is baffling and perplexing. This strange and destructive force is an unknown quantity to medical and surgical science." In fact, there was one person who had realized exactly what the problem was, one person, that is, beyond the chemist, Dr. Zamatulski, who had long ago identified that such trouble as may have been caused is due to the radium. In September 1924, Dr. Bloom, having now treated Hazel Kuzer for 8 months, made an address to the American Dental Association about jaw necrosis. He referenced only Hazel's case, and merely in a brief footnote, but it was he who made the first ever mention in medical literature of what he now termed radium jaw. He didn't believe the company's protestations of innocence. In fact, fueled by their cold-hearted response when he had begged them to help his patient, he now promised Hazel all necessary assistance should court action be brought versus the company. One might have thought that this new term, radium jaw, and the dentist's groundbreaking diagnosis would have captured the imagination of the medical community. But in fact, it went entirely unnoticed by other dentists, by the dial painters who were not privy to medical publications, and by physicians like Dr. Humphreys in Orange. Standing before Quinta McDonald's X-ray in that summer of 1924, completely at a loss, Humphreys nevertheless had to offer a diagnosis to his patient. Quinta remembered, "They told me that I had an arthritic hip." Humphreys duly strapped her leg for a month, but, unlike with Grace Fryer, there was no improvement. And so, That summer, Quinta McDonald was encased in plaster from her diaphragm down to her knees to keep her body absolutely still in the hope that it would mend her troubles. "I could still hobble around," she said, "with a cane." But hobbling around wasn't much good for the mother of two young children. It was even harder trying to care for Robert and Helen after that. It is likely that Quinta's sister, Albina, who was still without her own family, helped out. The two sisters now lived some 15 minutes' walk away from each other in Orange. To Quinta's relief, the dramatic treatment seemed to bear fruit. That cast eased the pain and helped a little, she remembered. She tried not to think of what was happening beneath the cast, of what she'd started to suspect, that one leg was beginning to shrivel up and become shorter than the other. The cast stayed on for 9 long months. As summer turned into fall, and she felt some improvement, she gave thanks that Dr. Humphrey's treatment appeared to have helped her. It was a time for thanks. On Thanksgiving itself, November 27th, Hazel Kooser was finally released from her New York hospital and allowed to return to Newark to be with Theo and her mother, Grace. As the family gathered together, they tried to feel the blessing of the fact that at least she was home. But she wasn't the same person anymore. She had suffered so frightfully that her mind seemed affected. Her priest, Carl Quimby, who was attending the family to offer spiritual comfort, said, "She suffered excruciating agony." It was perhaps, then, when they tried to think of Hazel and put her first, the biggest blessing of all when, on Tuesday, December 9th, 1924, she finally passed away. She died at 3 o'clock a.m. at home, with her husband and mother by her side. She was 25. By the time she died, her body was in such a distressing condition that the family would not allow her friends to see it at the funeral. It was Theo who notified the authorities of her passing. Theo, who organized the embalming of her battered body and her burial on December 11th in Rosedale Cemetery. These were the final things he could do for her, for the woman he had loved since he was a boy. He didn't want to think about the future, about the fact that the mortgage on their home had been foreclosed, about the fact that his father had impoverished himself in helping him and Hazel with their bills. By the time she died, Theo Sr. had spent all of his life savings. The family's bills, for hospitals, X-rays, ambulances, physicians, house calls, medicine, and transport to New York, ran to almost $9,000. $125,000. They had ruined themselves, and it was all for nothing. Catherine Wiley of the Consumers League, who had stayed in touch with the family as she continued to support the Dial Painter's cause, found the situation unbearable. Frustrated that nothing had been done by the authorities, she now pursued two leads. First, she wrote to Dr. Alice Hamilton, a brilliant scientist who was considered the founder of industrial toxicology and who always championed the victims of occupational disease. Hamilton was the first ever female faculty member of Harvard University, and her department chair happened to be one Cecil Drinker. Hamilton knew nothing of Drinker's report on the orange plant, for although Roeder was using it to quash the fears of his employees and to justify the company's refusal to help the afflicted women, Drinker had not yet submitted it for any official publication. Thus, on receipt of Wiley's letter, not aware of any conflict of interest, Hamilton enthusiastically expressed the desire that the Consumers League should take up the cases vigorously, with whatever cooperation I can give you. She wrote, "From what I can hear of the attitude of the company, it is pretty callous." She proposed that perhaps she could undertake her own study as a special investigator. Wiley's second line of attack was to reach out to Dr. Frederick Hoffman, a 59-year-old statistician who specialized in industrial diseases and worked for the Prudential Insurance Company. After reading Wiley's letter, Hoffman began making inquiries. His first port of call, at Wiley's urging, was to visit Marguerite Carlow. It was now almost a year since Marguerite had made that fateful Christmas Eve trip to the dentist. By the time Hoffman visited her in December 1924, he found her a lamentable case which is lingering between life and death, with apparently no hopeful outlook for the future. He couldn't help but be moved. Before the year was out, Hoffman, a recognized authority on occupational hazards, had sent a strongly worded letter to President Roeder at USRC. "If the disease in question were compensable, I seriously doubt if your company would escape liability," he wrote pointedly. And he added that it will be made compensable in the course of time if further cases should arise, is self-evident. A warning shot had been fired, and the orange dial painters were determined that this would be only the start of it. Marguerite, in particular, could not stop thinking that she had given her all to that company, and this was how they repaid her. Out in the cold, not a cent to spare to ease her suffering. And not just her, her friends, too. Though it had been a long time since she had felt like herself, Marguerite could dimly remember how she used to be, a dynamic young woman in sleekly fitted tailored clothes with fabulous millinery. That winter, as the calendar pages turned and the new year began, she gathered all her courage and what little strength she had left. She asked her family for help, being too weak now to do what she needed. But this was important. This she would do, even if it was her last act on earth. Against all the odds, Marguerite Carlow found a lawyer to take her case, and on February 5th, 1925, she filed suit against the United States Radium Corporation for $75,000. $1 million. The dial painter's fight back had begun. 15. Ottawa, Illinois, 1925. Marguerite's legal case made the local news in Newark. It's unlikely that the radium dial girls in Ottawa got to hear of it, but their employers certainly did. The radium industry was a small pond, and radium dial was one of the biggest fishes of them all. By 1925, the studio in Ottawa had become the largest dial painting plant in the country, supplying 4,300 dials a day. Business was booming, and radium dial wanted to take no chances of having a holdup in their operations, such as their fellow Radium Corporation had suffered when the rumors first started in New Jersey. Radium Dial now conceived a master plan to avoid the same problem. They opened a second dial painting studio in Streeter, 16 miles south of Ottawa, where less was known about radium. Both plants ran simultaneously for 9 months, but once it was apparent the Ottawa workers hadn't heard the rumors from the east and weren't going to quit, the firm shut down the second studio. Some employees transferred to Ottawa. Others simply lost their jobs. The company also decided, just as USRC had done before them, to have their workers medically tested later in the year. The exams were conducted by a company doctor in Mr. Reed's home on Post Street. Not all the women were tested. Catherine Wolfe was not among them. That was a shame, because just lately she had not been feeling too well. After 2 years of working at Radium Dial, she later remembered, "I began to feel pains in my left ankle, which spread up to my hip." She'd started to limp, just a little, every now and again, when that ache made itself known. Another Dial painter who wasn't tested was Della Harveston, who had been part of the original clique with Catherine, Charlotte, and Mary Vicini, Ella Cruz, and Inez Corcoran. She had died the previous year of tuberculosis. Red-haired Peg Looney, however, was summoned by Mr. Reed to his home for a test. Yet when her colleagues asked her how she'd got on, she had to tell them she hadn't a clue. In Orange, the medical exam results had been secretly shared with the company behind the women's backs. In Ottawa, they went straight to the corporation and cut out the middle woman entirely. Neither Peg nor any of her tested co-workers were told the results. Peg settled back at her desk in the studio without worry, however, picking up her brush and licking her lips in preparation for painting. She wasn't at all concerned. The company, she was sure, would tell her if anything was wrong. All the girls in Ottawa still lip-pointed, little knowing that 800 miles away the practice had been banned. Yet, behind the scenes at the head office of Radium Dial, its executives, mindful of the New Jersey lawsuit, now started putting some thought into finding an alternative method of applying the paint, just in case. Chamois was tested, but found too absorbent. Rubber sponges were employed, but they didn't work right. Radium Dial's Vice President Rufus Fordyce admitted, however, that their endeavors were somewhat half-hearted. "No strenuous effort," he later acknowledged, "has been made to find and provide any suitable manner to eliminate the procedure." The company eventually tasked Mr. Reed with the job of finding an alternative method. Soon, he would start tinkering with the idea of a glass pen, such as was employed by Swiss Dial painters, and he would begin to work up various designs. In the meantime, the Ottawa girls kept on. Lip, dip, paint. Their fun times kept right on, too. These days, many of them had a man on their arm as the young women started courting. Back in high school, Peg Looney's favorite song had been the independent-minded, "I Ain't Nobody's Darling." But now she had changed her tune. She was stepping out with a bright young man called Chuck. Anyone with half a brain could see that any one of these days he was going to propose. Chuck was his nickname. His full title was the much more distinguished-sounding Charles Hackensmith. He was a gorgeous, well-muscled, broad-shouldered, and tall young man with curling fair hair. His high school yearbook said the phrase that defined him was, "And the cold marble athlete leaped to life." Yet, to be the beau of clever Peg Looney, you couldn't be all brawn and no brain, and Chuck was as smart as he could be. He made the senior honor roll at high school and was a college guy. "He was big educated," said Peg's sister Jean. "He was everything. He was just elegant, really. Awful good." He grew up living just around the block from Peg and her large family, and although he was now away at college, he came home on weekends, and that was when the young couple really let their hair down. Chuck had a shack at his house where he would throw parties and play records on his beat-up old gramophone. As spectators clapped along and drank illicit home-brewed root beer, the dancing would begin. Whenever Chuck hugged Peg to him, he left not an inch between them, two bodies pressed close as they danced to the latest jazz tunes. Chuck was flirtatious. This girl, he knew, was something special. Everybody would go down to the shack. Marie Becker would have a hoot there. She would zip about between friends if a party was taking place, encouraging everyone